on June 14, the man carrying a shotgun opened fire on a group of Republican lawmakers and aides practicing ahead of the annual congressional baseball game. Five people were injured, including House Majority Whip Steve Scalise, who's still recovering. The gunman was a 66-year-old who had been an open supporter of left-wing causes and had volunteered for Senator Bernie Sanders while he ran for president. The gunman later died after being shot. The scope of the Second Amendment has been something that has long been debated by lawmakers and has been one of the most divisive issues in American politics. But our next guest says that there could be some middle ground between lawmakers when it comes to addressing shootings. Jeet here is with us now. He's a senior editor at the New Republic and recently wrote a piece about this topic. Jeet, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Well, what are your thoughts about the early reactions from lawmakers about the shooting on June 14th?
Sure. I think there's been so many shootings, and this is not even like the first sort of congressional shooting in recent years, right? But that people have sort of these kind of fixed responses. There's sort of like immediate things like, well, you can't politicize a shooting, that this is not an issue of guns, or on the other side saying that this is an issue of guns. I think it's it may be useful to try to like sidestep some of the formulaic responses and try to disentangle what exactly is happening with these shootings. And they do tend to follow certain common patterns.
So when you talk about disentangling what's really happening, what do you see really happening?
Well, okay, I think that there's a couple of commonalities with shooters. I think a lot of people pointed out that many of these events, whether you want to call it terrorism or not, sort of political violence, mass shootings, involve men, first of all, and men who have a history of domestic violence and are otherwise sort of like troubled individuals. And then these figures become sort of radicalized by movements of various sorts. And it could be anything. It could be sort of, white nationalist racist movements. It could be sort of jihadi Islamic extremism. This fellow was a sort of, left-wing Democrat. So it's this combination of, troubled individual with sort of anger management issues combined with coming into contact with polarizing rhetoric on social media. And so I think some of those issues, are potentially addressable. I strongly support gun control, but I think that it's like you also have to look at the larger society. To have a combination of a society which is very Darwinistic and lets people fall through the cracks and doesn't address issues of violence and domestic abuse, and to also have a lot of guns freely available and a polarized political moment, that's usually a toxic combination,
So where do you think the points of intervention might be if you take that individual who might have some undiagnosed mental illness, who has exhibited domestic violence, as you talked about, who comes in contact with that rhetoric? Where in that trajectory, before you get to the point of violence, should there be an intervention ready to go?
Well, I certainly think much more money, spent on mental health would be useful. I think people who do have domestic violence could get much more treatment. I guess the sort of politically controversial point is, I think that there's a pretty solid logical case that they should also be denied access to guns. And I think that that's where we kind of get into problems. And I guess the other maybe point to watch out for is this whole issue of sort of radicalization. And I think that there's been a lot of work done in Europe with sort of Islamic communities and to get people to be sort of sensitive and to watch out for that. And it's sort of interesting that there's even there a sort of policy failure because police aren't always attentive to what community says. So I think in recent terrorist acts in England, the terrorist had been sort of pointed out to by community members, but there wasn't enough done to address that. But I mean, yeah, I think that so it seems like there's a whole several different points at which there could be prior intervention.
You mentioned you think there's a case to be made that if someone has mental illness, that they shouldn't be able to get a gun. It's
I think. Sorry to clarify. I think that for me, it's like the issue of domestic violence, or you know, like anger, having sort of a history of violence.
Okay, so not mental illness, but who has engaged in domestic violence?
Yeah, yeah. I think that mental illness is a little bit of a red herring, at least. Like, I don't think there's necessarily, as I understand it, I'm not like, you know, like a sociologist, obviously, but I'm sort of based on people I've talked to and what I've read. It's not necessarily like mental illness is the activating factor. It's more sort of issues of anger or being socially troubled or alienated.
The domestic violence aspect is one that has been written about a little bit, but not a lot. Can you tell us about some of the shooters and their experience with domestic violence?
Sure. Yeah, I think like almost all of them have. I think the fellow, in the most recent case, had several instances involving both his daughter and girlfriends. I'm trying to think of like the other. There was a fellow who shot up the Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado, and he had like a sort of like a history of violence. But I think that there's a pretty strong correlation, like in these events, including the sort of jihadi terrorist. The fellow in Florida who shot up the nightclub, he had sort of custody issues and history of violence with his wife as well.
We're talking to Jeet here right now, senior editor of The New Republic, talking about the case about how Congress might be able to find ground that they can agree upon to fight political violence. And Jeet, you were talking about the correlation between domestic violence and some of the recent shootings that we've seen. And why do you think that aspect of domestic violence hasn't been getting much of a focus in terms of a focal point for people to step in and say, well, maybe this is a flag we should zero in on? I mean, is there a reason you think that the media and others have overlooked that?
Yeah, I do think that there's a tendency to sort of like normalize domestic violence or not to see it as a problem. I mean, or to see it as like a private foible rather than, you know, something that has public issues. We sort of like still treated, you know, despite all the efforts and changes that have been made, it's still not treated with the same degree of seriousness. And so we don't quite make the connection. And I think also, you know, like, I think there is a tendency to want to kind of, like, you know, draw attention to the sort of flagrantly ideological aspects of these things, you know, to say, oh, well, the killer was a, you know, white supremacist or a left-wing radical or a jihadi, and, you know, like, not to, like, look at the sort of personal factors that went into the who they are.
Do you think that that's something that could change and that could be agreed upon by members of Congress?
Well, I think that the effort is worth making. Yeah, I think that I mean, I'm not sure about like the sort of the current Congress, but I think that the I do think that like I think that it's something that has a sort of broad sort of social interest, and like I think especially, you know, it's a way of like dealing with the issue of violence without getting into the sort of polarizing problems that we have with other kind of solutions.
Now, as you were getting at there before, domestic violence, it's an issue that largely, not totally by any means, but largely affects women and girls, and hence is sort of treated as more of a foible than as something more serious. Is that itself a hurdle in bringing that to consciousness, to political awareness?
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's like the chief hurdle, in fact, I think. I mean, in some ways, it's a different sort of political fight, in the sense that what you're trying to do is not, you know, go against a sort of preset enemy as in the gun control debate, but to actually make people aware of it. But I mean, I do think that there's a history of like things that are sort of taken for granted and then become politicized or become aware of them as problems. I always think of like, you know, drinking and driving, like, you know, within our lifetime, or, you know, our parents' lifetime, certainly in the 60s and 70s, you know, you could watch, like, TV shows, and Dean Martin would be making jokes about drinking and driving. It was just treated as, you know, this kind of, like, hilarious thing. And then Mothers Against Drunk Driving, like, really brought it as, like, no, this is, like, a problem. And there are, like causes to it, and there are patterns, and there's, like, laws and ways we can, like, reduce it. And that's been done. So I think there is, like, there are models for, like, making people aware of social problems.
We're talking with Jeet here right now from the New Republic, and he's with us today to talk about, among other things, the link between domestic violence and violence in the public sphere in terms of shootings, and also how Congress might be able to find common ground like that to come together to fight political violence. He wrote about that in the New Republic, and you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think? What kind of conversations should we be having in the country about these issues to come together from the different perspectives, in particular regarding guns? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. What do you think it would take for the domestic violence issue and its link to mass violence? What would it take to bring that to the fore? You can also leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about how Congress might be able to reduce political violence and reach new common ground with Jeet here. He's a senior editor at the New Republic, and he recently wrote a piece on this following the shooting of a congressman at baseball practice. And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. Why do you think political polarization has gotten so bad in the United States? And what do you think we can do to combat violence from a bipartisan perspective? What about this domestic violence aspect that we're talking about? Call us at 800-642-1234 or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. And let's take our first caller now. We've got Willem on the line in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hello. I think part of the problem is the political power of the money of the NRA, and that makes a certain number of politicians unwilling to address the issue of any kind of common sense gun control in this country. And I think the other issue is, I think, a fundamental misreading of the Second Amendment. And, you know, oftentimes it's said that conservatives are textualists and originalists when it comes to the Second, or it comes to the Constitution. So if I could, I would like to read the Second Amendment. It's only one sentence.
Sure, go for it.
A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It's not about what the NRA often whips up, like the people who occupied federal land, that the people need to be armed against an overreaching government. That's not what the Second Amendment says. It's about a well-regulated militia protecting a free state. And I think that the other thing is the NRA, I look at some of their publications, and they often have like a footprint on the Constitution, and then they're not willing to control any amount of regulation on weaponry, what kind of bullets, who can own them, and they're always citing the Second Amendment. I think this is a fundamental misreading of the Second Amendment.
Thanks for that call. And Jeet, what do you say to that comment?
Yeah, no, I mean, I also strongly support gun control, and I do think the Second Amendment is being applied in ways which, like, is very novel. Like, it wasn't the case that for most of American history it was seen in such extreme terms. I will say that I think that in some ways the polarization feeds into the gun issue as well, in the sense that the people who are very take the NRA point of view, it's not just that they care about guns, but they also see themselves as beleaguered in the same way that other conservative groups did. The NRA just did this kind of like ad, which was very frightening, of like saying, you know, like these terrible liberals and Hollywood elites, and they hate us. And the interesting thing was, like, there's almost nothing about guns in there. Like, I don't even know if there's like more than a sentence about guns. And it was really about the divide in America and how there are these terrible people out there. I think that the well, so in some ways it's like almost like a chicken and egg thing, like, right? There's a sort of polarization over guns, and then the more people argue about it, the more polarized they become. So it's a very hard, it's very hard to see how you can move forward politically on that.
Well, and thank you for that call, and we'll go next to Greg in Baraboo. Greg, hi.
Hi. Well, I'd like to first point out to your guests that domestic violence is a huge problem, and there are currently laws against people who have been convicted of the misdemeanor of domestic violence from possessing weapons. And those laws have been on the books for a while now. In fact, it was retroactive. So somebody in the 1940s who may have been convicted of that, police officers, et cetera, were out of a job because they had that on the books. As far as the Second Amendment, the well-regulated militia is the people, and the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The reason it's the Second Amendment is because it helps enforce all the other amendments. The Battle of Concord wasn't because the British were coming to take their rifles or muskets. It was because they were coming to take their cannons.
Greg, thank you so much for your thoughts. I appreciate you calling. And Greg's got a couple of points there, Jeet, beginning with the input that he's saying that there are laws on the books already that accomplish what you're getting at there about domestic violence laws.
I don't think that they seem to be like sufficient because in a lot of these cases, certainly in the Orlando case and in the Virginia case, the guns, these were men who had like a record of violence, and their guns were actually legally bought. It's not like that they were like criminals. So whatever laws there are don't seem sufficient. And then I guess, as to the, you know, interpretation of the Second Amendment, you know, we'll just have to agree to, like, disagree. I mean, I would just point out that it is just historically the case that the most extreme interpretation is a novelty. This is not, that's not the interpretation that was seen by the courts for most of for the 19th century or most of the 20th century.
Greg, thanks a lot for the call. And G, do you think that we'll end up seeing more politically motivated violence given the atmosphere that we live in, the political polarization? Is this something you think that we haven't figured out how to get a handle on from whatever perspective you're on right now?
Yeah, I'm very pessimistic about this. And I do think that, yeah, there are these kind of like larger sort of social forces. In some ways, one shouldn't be too pessimistic because there are other ways in which America's crime problem is actually under control. I mean, there has been a long-term decline in murder in general, but there hasn't been a decline in mass shootings. Those keep going up, and so we kind of have to think that there's something that. So this is not something connected with ordinary criminality, which is in decline. There's something about sort of modern culture that creates individuals who are very easily radicalized by things they see in media. Look to violence as a solution.
In our last couple of minutes here, let's talk a little bit more about mental illness as a factor alongside the domestic violence you were talking about. Does there need to be better care, maybe health care, mental health care provided for people in this country who are struggling with mental illness?
Yeah, I definitely think that would be a huge kind of factor, and it could be useful. As I said it's a particular type of troubled individual, like the sort of one with a propensity towards violence. But I mean, having said that, I mean, like sort of like mental illness itself is a big problem and deserves care. And I think that like a society that had a more sweeping effort at mental illness would also be one that would be more alert to individuals that are going off the rail and have violent tendencies.
Let's take one more quick call from Melissa from Racine. And Melissa, if you could be brief, please.
Very brief. I think one of the issues related to violence is, in order to know the scope of the problem and address it, you have to have data. And organizations that get federal money are prohibited from collecting gun violence data. And so I really think that we need to be able to do that in order to assess the scope of the problem.
Melissa, thank you so much for that call. And Jeet, in our last 30 seconds here, what do you say to that?
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, the NRA has actually prevented the Center for Disease Control and other organizations from collecting data, and that's a big problem. How can you solve a problem if you can't even gather information?
Melissa, thanks for that call. And Jeet, thank you to you for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, RA. This is really nice.
That was Jeet Heer, senior editor at The New Republic, and he joined us today to talk about how lawmakers might be able to find middle grounds, points of intervention to come together and work at reducing political violence. He was looking there at aspects of domestic violence and also mental illness.